welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really glad to be joining you today. We have a very interesting program lined up, and we'll get into a lot of what's going to happen in the back end of the program when that starts to happen.
All right, not really. I couldn't get away with that if I tried. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Jim Cavallaro. Jim is with the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford University. And that clinic and Jim are co-authors of a new report, a recently released report called Living Under Drones. And this is going to be an incredibly gripping and compelling conversation, so don't miss that one. And before that, we'll be hearing from Bob Avakian, a recorded segment from a speech Bob Avakian gave a little while back called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this is about the climate and capitalism and the fact that they are not fit caretakers of the earth. So make sure you stay tuned for that one.
But first, I really wanted to, you know, as people know, if you've listened to the show on a regular basis, you know, I get very concerned about what's happening to the planet, about the question of global warming, and not even a question, I don't even like posing it as the question of global warming, the fact of global warming, the fact of climate change, the fact that this planet is being changed so dramatically and is changing so dramatically as a result of what's being done to it, that the question, in some ways, the question of the future of not just humanity, but of the planet and everything on it is pretty precarious and being called into question. And recently there was a symposium held in Monterey, California that exposed the impact of ocean acidification, which is a result of carbon emissions. And it talked about its impact on coral reef, shellfish, and other marine life. And as I read that article, not only did I get sputtering and spitting mad, but I also thought back to, what was it, back in the spring of 2011, when I brought to you this report that was done by a group of scientists in London, in England, and actually I think it was in Europe, it was in England, but it was for the first time that hundreds of scientists who have been working individually on all these different aspects of what's happening to the oceans came together and brought all their information together and emerged with a really just amazing, very, very heavy assessment of what's going on. And I thought it'd be important to reach back to that, to base ourselves on that understanding, and to talk about what this new symposium in Monterey talked about just a little while ago in terms of the ocean acidification. And joining us to talk about this and what it means for the future of the planet is Dr. Alex Rogers. Alex is a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology and a fellow of Somerville College, University of Oxford. And he's actually somebody who was actually a participant in that conference that I was talking about in 2011. And Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Sure. This symposium. Now, I know you weren't at the one in Monterey, but it stands on the shoulders of what you folks did just, as I said, in the spring of 2011. And I'd like you to explain to people, you know, when they talk about the acidification of the ocean, for a lot of people, I think that goes over their heads, or if they're like me and they spent way too much time watching cartoons when they were a kid, and okay, a little bit now, you think about jumping in the ocean, acidification, you jump in the ocean, you're swimming, all of a sudden it's just your bones are swimming. What does it mean that the ocean is becoming, there's the acidification of the ocean?
Well, the ocean's been doing this fantastic service for humankind by actually absorbing about one-third of the carbon dioxide and, in fact, some other more noxious gases that we've been producing as a result of being largely industrialized cultures. And as this carbon dioxide gets absorbed by the oceans, it's actually converted into an acid called carbonic acid. And that has the effect of reducing the pH, which is the way in which we actually measure the level of acidity of the oceans. In other words, it actually makes the oceans more acidic. And that has some very serious effects on the chemistry of seawater, including reducing the amount of carbonate in seawater.
Well, now, you know, there's a huge, as you know, and I don't put any stock in this in terms of the, you know, the people that are challenging all this, but there's a huge counteroffensive that's going on in society at large, where, you know, scientists are really having to fight to struggling to actually get these things, these kinds of studies put out, and the kind of understanding that you're talking about put out into the society at large and taken seriously. And you're coming up against a whole movement that is built around, at the very best, confusing the issue, and at the very worst, outright lies about what's going on, including the fact that a lot of people might say, well, if you look at things in the overall time span in the history of the planet, these kinds of things have happened many times before. It's just a natural process. What do you say about that?
Well, in one sense, they're actually right. And this is where the subtlety of the whole problem comes in. And that sense is that in absolute terms, yes, the oceans probably have been as acidic as they are now and probably more acidic in the past. The massive difference is the sheer rate at which the current increase in acidification is taking place. So whereas in the past these changes would have taken place over many millions of years, what we're seeing now is a situation where in the space of 250 years, and this is, you know, less than the blink of an eye in geological terms, the pH of the ocean has declined by 0.1 pH unit. Now, that might not sound like very much, but that actually means a 30% increase in the acidity of the ocean, or a 30% increase in the amount of hydrogen ions or protons in seawater. So that is, in fact, a huge change, especially when you think that the oceans comprise about a billion cubic kilometers of water.
Alex, let me interrupt for 1 minute to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Dr. Alex Rogers, and we're talking about the acidification of the ocean and what's happening, what the impact of that is on humanity, and actually, more importantly, actually, the planet itself. Now, Alex, tell me something. You know, you were saying that this, you know, that the, in a sense, people were right in terms of it being a natural process, but there's something much, much more going on. And, you know, a lot of times people will ask, well, why is it happening now? If this has been going on for, you know, hundreds of millions of years, why now? What's changed to make this pace so much different, so much more accelerated than in the past?
Yeah, let me just say that there's no way that this is a natural process. What I was saying was that we've seen changes in ocean pH in the past, which have been caused by natural processes, but they take place over much longer periods of time. This is actually caused by human activity. That is absolutely and completely clear. There's no doubt at all about that. It's caused by production of greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide, which, as I said, is absorbed by the ocean, and that's converted into carbonic acid, which makes the ocean more acidic. And as I said, the thing about that is the sheer speed at which it's happening.
Now, Alex, you know, you're saying, again, we get back to this question of the pace, but, you know, here's the thing. I agree with you, but I'm trying to pose some of these questions that have come up, and particularly in relation to all these deniers, you know, that come up, and as I said, not only try to confuse the issue, but actually to wage a war on actual scientific knowledge and try to pretend that there's such a thing. There should be a debate around whether this is happening and not how the hell are we going to stop it. You know, when people might say to you, okay, well, look, again, you know, there's always been a certain level of carbon dioxide in the ocean. I mean, that's part of what the ocean does, is it cleans the air. Why? What has made it so different? You said it's absolutely a result of anthropogenic changes in the atmosphere, you know, human made changes. What makes you say that so assuredly? And then let's talk about what the impact on life on the oceans actually is.
Well, we can measure where carbon dioxide is coming from on the planet. So, for example, we can measure the amount that's being produced by living organisms. We can measure the amount that's coming from other natural sources such as volcanoes, bacterial activity, and so on, breaking down organic material. So we can actually really get a very good idea of how carbon dioxide production is partitioned between different sources on planet Earth. And that's how we can basically identify the portion of that CO2 that's coming from human activities.
And what's the impact on this? Actually, the actual impact, it's measurable. It's not something that people are guessing at. There's actually measurable impact and visible impact on life in the oceans and on the oceans themselves, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's an increasing number of studies which are showing impacts. And in fact, some of those impacts have been seen most visibly on the west coast of the United States, where there have been these large kills in aquaculture facilities along the U.S. associated with acidified water basically coming into the coastal zone from offshore. But other effects we've seen have mainly been on organisms or animals and plants that actually secrete skeletons made out of calcium carbonate, basically limestone. And in some cases, we're able to actually measure a decrease in the rate in which those organisms or animals and plants secrete that calcium carbonate, secrete their skeletons. And over time, where we've been able to sample animals from the past, we've also seen a decrease in the size of some of those animals as a direct result of this acidification process and its impact on carbonate levels in seawater.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Dr. Alex Rogers. You know, I keep thinking back to the report that you were involved in pulling together back in the spring of 2011, where you talked about negative synergies between different things that are going on in the ocean and in the environment overall. Can you talk about how the impact of acidification relates to these to other threats to the ocean in terms of this negative synergy that you guys kept hitting at very hard?
Yeah, one of the things about the pH of seawater is that it affects all other aspects of chemistry. So anything which involves chemical speciation in seawater is influenced by pH. And also, it can interact with other impacts arising from either direct human activities or from other impacts associated with climate change. One of the examples we pulled out in the report was that corals, for example, as a result of the warming of seawater, because of all this CO2 in the atmosphere, have started to develop a phenomena called mass coral bleaching. And this has been happening since the late 1970s. And it's been found that as seawater becomes more acidic, corals bleach at lower and lower temperatures. So there's an interaction there between the warming effect of having all this CO2 in the atmosphere and also the effect in terms of reduction of pH of seawater.
Now, you're talking about what has happened, what the effect has been. Can you also give us a sense of what might happen or what is predicted to happen?
Well, if we carry on at this rate, we're going to see significant changes in entire ecosystems as a result of both the effect of acidification and also warming. The most devastating effects, I think, will be seen in ecosystems which are characterized by animals which use calcium carbonate to build their skeletons. So in particular, coral reefs are particularly vulnerable to this type of change. If we carry on at the present rate, by somewhere between the middle and the end of this century, a lot of those ecosystems, a lot of coral ecosystems, will be in terminal decline as a result of this phenomenon.
Now, when you say terminal decline, let's talk about that a little bit more. What do you actually mean by that? And what would be the impact of life on land if all this was to roll out the way you're describing it?
Terminal decline means that those systems would be in a downward spiral of degradation from which there is no recovery, and actually there would be nothing we could do about it at that point, simply because once you put a large amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it takes a very long time for it to be removed again. So a colleague of mine has this term, zombie reefs, which is his word for a coral reef which is there today, but has basically stopped reproducing and stopped growing. So that reef is doomed. And that is what I mean by terminal decline. Essentially, those systems would be doomed to destruction over the following period of decades. Mm-hmm. in terms of effects on the rest of the Earth system, obviously humankind relies on the oceans for many what scientists term goods and services. A very obvious one is food. So we get fish from the oceans. But actually, the oceans also carry out many other services for us. They play a big role in the cycling of important nutrients at the global scale. They regulate heat, all sorts of things which people take for granted. Another one is that they produce something near half of the oxygen that we breathe. So if we're interfering with the chemistry of this critical part of the Earth system, we're potentially interfering with some of those goods and services which we rely on as humankind to maintain the planet in a state which we can live in.
Now, let me ask you this. In your earlier report, in the one that you worked on, and I should tell people that Dr. Alex Rogers is also, he's a marine biologist. He's also the scientific director of the International Program on State of the Ocean, which is one of the groups that was involved in pulling together this really, really important study. If you haven't seen it, go get it. All right. It was in the spring of 2011, an extremely important study on what's going on in the oceans and it's what it portends for the whole planet. Now, you know, Alex, here's the question. You know, one of the things that has come up that you talked about in that report, you talked about the possibility of mass extinctions.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm kind of thinking about this. And I remember there was a report that just came out in relation to, I think it came out from Berkeley just a little while ago, that talked about the possibility of the planet shifting into something what they called a state shift. Whereas you mentioned earlier, and I'm thinking that's what you were talking about, we might actually end up in a place where things are so dramatically changed and there's nothing you can do about it, that it's actually shifted the entire state of existence of the planet into something very different. And that has happened previously in the history of the planet. What do you think of the danger of all that is?
Well, the danger is that we've actually evolved on the planet in the state that it's been over the last several millennia. And what we're talking about here is a shift to a state which we've never experienced before in the history of humankind. And by the same token, many of the biological systems which make up part of this planet that we live on and maintain the planet in the way that we're used to have also evolved in that environment. So what we're talking about is a significant shift in the state of the planet, and the result of that is going to be a significant shift in the patterns of how life is distributed and how it functions on planet Earth.
All right, one more question, Alex. Timelines for action are shrinking. It's one of the conclusions of the conference that you were involved in. Timelines for action are shrinking. What do you think about that? And then do you have in a minute or so what you would see as the critical thing that has to be done in order to begin to reverse this?
Well, it's quite interesting. We're working on a follow-up to the 2011 IPSO report, and that talks about solutions. But right up at the front of that solutions section, it simply says, before all of this, if we do not do something about the rate at which carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are being produced by human activity, then we're going to see, you know, massive change on the planet. And it's quite straightforward. We've got to basically reduce the rate at which we're producing carbon dioxide, and that's being released into the atmosphere. I say that's a simple thing. What it actually means is a complete change, really, in the way in which we live. And that's why it's politically such an explosive and very difficult thing to deal with at an international level. But the bottom line here is that people often talk about climate change in the sense of something that will happen in the future. You know, it might affect my children, might affect their children or whatever. We are already seeing huge changes as a result of climate change, and we have been seeing those changes since the 1970s in the oceans. In 1997-98, there was a big warming event in the oceans which killed in one go 16% of all the world's tropical coral reefs. So if we want to avoid seeing that continuing to happen in the future and more unpredictable events like that taking place, then we've really got to address this carbon dioxide problem with the levity that it deserves. And that is nothing less than a planetary emergency.
All right, Alex. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
And we'll have you back when that update of your report comes on. I really want to pursue this a lot more. So talk to you again soon.
That would be fantastic.
All
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Alex Rogers. Alex is a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology, University of Oxford, and a fellow of Somerville College. He's also the scientific director of the International Program on State of the Ocean.
All right, we're going to jump right quick into an excerpt from a speech that Bob Avakian gave called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this excerpt is all about capitalism and the environment, and it's called Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth. Check this out.
Let's look a little more fully at the history of this system, its crimes all over the world, as well as within the U.S. itself. Look at what their system is doing to the earth, how it is wrecking the environment. In places like Brazil, as well as in places in Africa and Asia, there are beautiful rainforests full of a rich diversity of species which are being torn down and destroyed by the ever-hungry engine of this system. These are not just short-term effects. This has a long-term effect on the environment, not just in those places, but all over the world. And it has an effect on the people, too. For example, in Brazil, indigenous people, whose way of life was based on living in the rainforest, wake up one day to see a bulldozer knocking down the trees 100 yards from where they've always lived. And what's the result of this? Many of them can no longer go on living the way they were before. And one of the things that happens is many of the young women go into the cities in Brazil to become prostitutes because that's the only way they can survive. And now we have people like Bush and them talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. Once again, hungry for oil without regard to the environment or the effects on the people for generations to come. At the same time, they're breaking or refusing to sign agreements on the environment, on global warming, backing out of these agreements if they made them in the first place. Once again, these are not just so-called isolated incidents they always tell us about, the few rotten apples. This is what they have done and are doing to the environment throughout the U.S. and all over the world. To take one outrageous example of this, within the memory of many people alive today, the U.S. government carried out testing of nuclear weapons, bringing contamination and poisoning of people even inside this country itself, along with the devastation and the driving out of the whole population of the Bikini Islands in the Pacific during the late 1940s and 50s. Because of this nuclear testing in their home was no longer livable for them. Now, recently I was reading an essay called Disarming Images, about an exhibit of art for nuclear disarmament, which was held in the early 1980s. And I noticed that the author of this essay points out that according to the dictionary, Webster's Third International Dictionary, the name bikini, given to the bathing suit, comes from comparing, quote, the effects of a scantily clad woman to the effects of an atomic bomb, unquote. When you think about this, and you think about the horrendous death, destruction, mutilation, and suffering alive before dying that was caused by the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, and what would result from the much more powerful nuclear weapons these monsters have today. When you think about all that, and you think about the reasons for naming the bikini after all that, and what kind of view of women this promotes, do you need any other proof of how sick this system is? And how sick is the dominant culture it produces and promotes? And speaking again of the environment, now they are not only gutting environmental protection laws and safeguards in the U.S. itself, they are insisting that governments everywhere in the world do the same. They are declaring that even limited attempts at environmental protection are an unfair obstacle to free trade. In other words, it is in the way of their endless rampage for more profit, without regard or consideration to the cost for humanity, in this generation and for generations to come. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now, while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. As our party's draft program makes clear, these people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's an excerpt from his speech called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. If you want to access the whole speech, go to revolutiontalk.net. You'll find Not Fit Caretakers of the Earth and a whole lot more, so check it out. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jim Cavallaro from the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic, and we'll be talking about the new report, Living Under Drones, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Slackers with International War Criminal. And that song today goes out to the king of kings of war criminals, Barack Obama. Yep, you heard it. I said it. You heard it. And you know it. This man has committed more war crimes than any other president in the history of this country. And yet people still seem to be getting fooled by him. Wake up. We won't talk about that anymore. Instead, we will be talking with James Cavallaro.
James is a professor of law, director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford University. And Jim is he was involved in this new report, that came out at the end of September. And that report was called Living Under Drones. And the report was co-authored with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Sure. You know, it's your study was just a mind-pounding study. I mean, you know, you sit here and anybody who's paid attention at what's going on in the world, and particularly in that region of the world, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that whole area of the world, the idea of this drone warfare, we hear it constantly, continuously. And, you know, some people are outraged, but really, generally, there's not enough outrage. And part of that, I think, comes from people looking at this as sort of a very clean, very surgical sort of, this is sort of just the way that war is conducted today. And actually, it's a nicer war. There's not as many American boys being killed in a war like this. Your study kind of slams that all to hell and says that the entire narrative around drone warfare is false. Can you tell our listeners what you're talking about there?
Well, to start, it's worth spending a bit of time on what the narrative has been. And I think you summarize it well. What I would add is the idea that has been dominant in mainstream media in the United States, and this is largely fostered by the official discourse, the main idea has been that drones and drone strikes are surgically precise, that the only casualties caused by drone strikes are terrorists. And since that has been the main narrative, naturally, it has served, among other things, to mute opposition to drones. We were very concerned by this narrative because information that we had and also others and organizations had approached us to see if we would be interested in investigating independently what the consequences of drones and drone strikes actually has been in Pakistan. And we took up that challenge and spent pretty much the year 2012 to date, investigating intensely what have been the consequences of drones and drone strikes in Pakistan. And the result of our work is the report that you cited, Living Under Drones. But in a sentence, and of course I'm happy to get into much more detail on this, is the dominant narrative of surgically precise strikes that hit only terrorists is simply false. That, in fact, drones hit civilians, drones hit all sorts of buildings, and that drones have a significant impact on entire communities who are on a daily basis terrorized by these unmanned vehicles flying overhead that at any moment can fire down a Hellfire missile that can kill anyone who happens to be within the blast radius.
Well, let's jump into this one at a time here, because one of the things that you just said about it's, you know, supposedly the narrative being it doesn't hit civilians, you're arguing that, in fact, it does. Civilians are deeply impacted, in fact, killed by it, killed by this drone warfare. And this is something that really, you know, well, look, frankly, we're living in a situation where the U.S. government basically says, you know, what did Brennan say? It was in the single digits, or there's virtually none. No civilians have been killed. You know, nobody in the U.S. regime actually admits to significant civilian murder as a result of this drone warfare. How do you speak to that?
Well, first, what's important, and there was an important piece written by Joe Becker and Scott Shane in late May in the New York Times, and that piece investigated the process by which drones are authorized, or at least some drones, and some drone strikes, rather. And I can get into the details of what the focus of that piece was and what could and should still be considered in more depth. But one of the very important revelations in that piece was that the administration counts those who are killed in a strike, if they are males of combatant age, which is quite a broad range. If a male in the relevant age range is killed in a drone strike, the administration considers that person to be a combatant unless there is posthumous evidence demonstrating that person's innocence. So think about that. Take a second. Wrap your head around that. What it means is if the United States fires a Hellfire missile from a drone and it kills some group of men, the United States considers that they're all militants. Well, of course, if that's your calculation method for establishing who is a militant or a combatant, of course your figures for non-militant or non-combatant deaths will be low. In fact, the presumption should be of innocence of those who were killed, and there should be some examination, a thorough examination into who the victims are. That's one of the major concerns that we had in this report, and one of the issues which we needs significant response and attention as soon as possible from the administration. But even without that mischaracterization of those who have been targeted, there is plenty of information, and we went through all the information in media sources and in what are called data aggregators, and there are three major data aggregators, and even the most conservative data aggregators, with whom we have significant issues because of their undercounting, even they are talking about scores and scores, if not hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And the most reliable data aggregator has calculated up to as many as 800, nearly 900 civilians killed. So the single digits narrative is fantasy, and it's highly problematic because what it does is it allows most people in the United States to accept the false narrative of surgically precise, terrorist-only weapons, almost as though these weapons were able to go down to a house level, knock on the door, establish that the person is a terrorist by overwhelming evidence, establish that the person is imminently plotting and about to strike and kill Americans, and then and only then killing the person. That's what it allows people to believe when that's not the case.
Yeah. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford. And Jim is Jim and the clinic there are one of the, they're one of the co-authors of a new report on drone warfare in Pakistan called Living Under Drones, and it just came out at the end of September. You get a chance, look that up, Living Under Drones. You're never going to be the same after reading it. Now, Jim, one of the things when you're talking about this, the idea that, and it struck me, especially when I saw this thing, and I'm familiar with the New York Times article you were, referring to. And when I saw this thing about they clear up any mistakes posthumously. I mean, one, I think you're right. you would think that they would, make that clarification, make that decision before they killed somebody. But even there's a certain cynicism and a real deep, disgusting, unreal thing in there, because posthumously after being hit by a drone is a pretty gruesome affair from what I understand in your report. It seems like that's actually almost a given that that's not going to happen.
Well, let me put it this way, because we can't know everything, and there's so much secrecy surrounding the U.S. drone practices. Virtually everything is shrouded, unfortunately, in an inappropriate secrecy, and evidently there's some margin that we understand for national security that might be legitimately invoked, but it's been used to cover everything related to the drone program, including its very existence. But again, what we know from the way drones work is those who are very close to the blast radius are incinerated. So it would be highly difficult, at a minimum, to establish information about those victims. But what I can say is we are unaware of any serious, comprehensive effort by the United States to find out almost anything about those who are struck by drones, and we also are aware of the fact that in many instances, authorities have been unable even to identify those who have been killed, much less to establish who the person was, what the person was doing, if the person was a combatant, etc. So, yes, you're right. There's very little to suggest that there is any significant attempt posthumously to exonerate those who have been killed, which leaves you with, if you were killed, you were a combatant. And then if you roll that backwards, what does that do, that knowledge that drone operators and administrators and administration authorities have, that if they make a mistake or if they target the wrong people, is unlikely to be any consequence, what does that do to their targeting decision and their willingness to fire drones? I don't know, but it's a question that concerns me.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing you guys raised in the report that really, really sort of just smacked me in the head is the point that they often describe, and you see this in the press all the time, they describe the victims of, or the targets, because they don't really ever talk about victims of, they talk about the targets of the drone attacks are all militants, which is a phrase you actually call for at the end of your report. You guys call for actually stop using the term militants so easily and start trying to define people as what they are, because militants does seem to be a word that's been thrown around to obfuscate everything that's really going on there. What's the story with that?
Yeah, it is, and I don't want to head too far into the realm of legalese, but militant is a term that sounds as though it legitimates or justifies the killing of the person. So that if a person is a militant, then that person could be killed by a drone. And that's not the case under international law. In order for a target to be legitimate under international humanitarian law, the laws of war, the person would not only have to be a combatant, but the person would have to be engaged in an activity that imminently threatens interests that the United States could protect, like, say, U.S. lives or interests in Afghanistan across the border, and there would have to be no means of capturing that person. So a person could be a militant or a combatant, not be posing a threat to U.S. interests, and or be subject to capture. And if any of those are the case, in other words, if the person is not presenting a threat to the United States, or if the person could be captured, then that person should not be killed by a drone strike, or could not or should not legally. So that's one issue, which is very important, is who can the United States kill or might it be able to kill legally, and who can it not kill? But secondarily, and this is in many ways the bigger issue, what we've seen in the mainstream media is that the reporting on drone strikes in an area known as FATA, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which is an area of extremely difficult access because of the terrain, but also because it's cordoned off by the Pakistani military, it's an area in which you simply can't enter. And what media sources have done is report, in effect, verbatim information from anonymous security officials about who was killed. So anonymous security officials who evidently have an interest in saying that those who they killed were combatants, as opposed to, hey, we killed a bunch of civilians today, they tell the media anonymously what they want the media to print, and the media then obediently, unfortunately, in many, many instances, has simply printed what they are asked to print by anonymous sources. We don't think that that's an appropriate role for an aggressive democratic media. And one of the things that we call on is for journalists to speak more critically about who are their sources and also to interrogate what they're saying. So that if the only source for the assertion that all of those who were killed are militants is an anonymous security official, maybe if you're a journalist, you say, we don't know who they are. They're people. They're men. Some people or some anonymous sources said they were militants, as opposed to militant, 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 militant throughout the article. So there is some responsibility here on the part of the media.
Tell me this, Jim. How does this add up when you throw in something that was, again, and I keep saying, it keeps, as you read the report, you keep getting more and more outraged. The idea of double tapping. Can you explain to my listeners what double tapping is and what that says about this, the civilian targeting?
So double tapping refers to a practice where a drone will fire a Hellfire missile, a first strike, and then shortly afterwards fire a second strike. And there have been a significant number of cases where this has been documented to have occurred in Pakistan. What that means in practice is there's a missile strike. It hits a target. It has a blast radius. There may be a number of people who are killed or maimed or injured in the blast radius. And now what's happened is when others, first responders, have gone in to assist those who are injured and may still be alive, a second strike kills them. And because that has happened so frequently, unfortunately, in an area known as North Waziristan, which is the epicenter of these strikes, the people with whom we spoke with 70 people from that area who had been directly affected by drone strikes, they told us that they won't go into an area where a drone has struck because they're afraid that they'll be the victim of a second strike. And we had some really gruesome testimony of people who were near enough to strikes to see victims, and the victims are screaming, and people won't go in to help them because they're afraid they'll be hit by another strike. But there's an important point here, Michael, which if I could elaborate here, is the nature of the drone strikes, double tapping, as it's called, is one phenomenon, is such that because people don't know when drones are going to strike, all sorts of ordinary activities have been affected in these areas, and people are suffering from significant psychological trauma, according to the symptoms that they described to us, and also according to the interviews that we did with mental health professionals who have treated people from that area.
Yeah, I want to get into that in just a second, but I want to remind listeners that we're talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law and the founding director of Stanford Law School's International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And that clinic is one of the co-authors, along with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, of a brand new study that's really worth you going out, finding the study, reading it, and thinking a whole hell of a lot on it. And then think about what you're going to do after you read that and understand what's going on. And the study is called Living Under Drones. Now, Jim, you started to talk about that, the Living Under Drones. What's the impact on this? I mean, as I understood, one of the things that blew my mind was when, you know, and I think there was somebody who was part of your team or part of the I can't remember whether it was with Stanford or NYU, Jennifer Gibson, I think her name was.
Jennifer Gibson was part of our research team
at
Stanford, and then graduated and has now working with an organization based in London.
Right. Well, she wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times where she talked about how so many of us think that a drone strike is like sort of, it comes in, the drone comes in, one or two of them come in, just appear out of nowhere, and that they fire a single missile or two missiles or whatever into a crowd of people, and then they disappear. She said, actually, you're talking about a situation where 24/7 people are living under the threat of drones, literally. Is that the case?
Well, so here's what we were able to document. You know, I went to Pakistan twice for a couple of weeks and spent time speaking with, again, this group of 70 people who in several trips came and met with us. who live in areas where drones fly overhead and who were directly affected because some of them themselves had been injured or maimed by drone strikes, or they'd lost a relative or many relatives, or because they'd had drones hovering over and had fired down Hellfire missiles in their communities. So these are people who are living constantly under drones. And what they told us, and this was really probably what really had the greatest impact on us, as much as the death and destruction and maiming evidently has an impact on anyone, what they told us is the drones in their communities hover overhead at times 24 hours a day for several days on end. They emit a buzzing sound, and we spoke with many, many people, and they would imitate the sound like a bee. It's something that even when they're sleeping, it's there, and it's in the back of their heads. And they have no idea when one of these drones will fire a Hellfire missile down on their communities. They also don't know where it will hit or who it will hit. So imagine what this does to them on a daily basis. They're walking in the bazaar. They don't want to get too close to someone if they don't know who that person is, because maybe that person is suspected of being a combatant by the drone operator, and maybe a drone will hit that person. And if it does, and if I'm within 15 or 20 yards, I will be killed by the shrapnel. So that's the logic, and what it's done is it's cast a pall on all sorts of activities. People told us, for instance, they don't go out of their houses unless they have to. They don't congregate with three or four men anymore. They don't go to religious services. They don't go to funerals. In short, they don't. And here's maybe the worst is many people told us they don't send their children to school anymore because they don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to be. They don't know if they're going to wander into an area where there's a group of men that might look to someone in, say, Nevada, who's watching a video image, like a group of militants or combatants. So the entire community has been profoundly affected. And the other major effect, evidently related to the first, are the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms of other psychological maladies, of stress-related disorders, that many people with whom we spoke told us about their suffering themselves and of many others in their community suffering. And I would say in a short sentence, the United States has not declared war on Pakistan and is not officially engaged in a war in North Waziristan, but the narratives of the people in that area were narratives that sounded like people living in a war zone. That's the way the people living under drones experience drones and drone strikes.
I'll tell you, it's incredible. You know, Jim, I want to, and let me remind listeners again, we're talking with Jim Cavallaro from Stanford, and he's one of the co-authors of a new study called Living Under Drones. Jim, tell me this, and we're running up on our time, so I want to make sure we get a chance to speak to this, and I know you were careful not to get into all the legalese and legalisms in terms of language before, but a significant part of your study actually does raise the question of the legality or illegality of all this. And that really strikes me because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, you know, how many crimes are going to be allowed to be committed? And to me, it really, you know, from my own viewpoint, after reading your study and my own thinking about it beforehand, these kinds of things, at the very least, must violate half a dozen international law. You know, it just seems to me humanitarian law has to be violated time and time again in the process of this whole drone warfare system. What did you guys find about that?
So I'll try and be succinct, but let me start by saying there is significant evidence, and we've pulled it together in this report, and there are other sources as well that demonstrate that there is every likelihood that many, many drone strikes have occurred in violation of international law. But here's what makes it a tricky, and this is part of, I would say, the strategy, although I can't speak to knowingly what the strategy of the administration is, but it seems as though this may be what they've been thinking. You can imagine a hypothetical scenario, one can imagine, where there is a person in North Waziristan, a combatant, and the combatant is about to fire a missile, and the missile will strike and kill I don't know how many Americans in Afghanistan, hypothetically. okay? And there's no way to arrest this person. And the person has the missile and is about to fire it and is about to strike it. And in that circumstance, one can imagine, well, it might be legal under those circumstances as described for the U.S. or someone to use some sort of lethal military strike, such as a drone, to attack that person before the person who is about to imminently attack and kill many Americans can fire the missile he's about to fire, right? So you can imagine, you can work into the intellectual possibility of that occurring. Here's what happens. Because that intellectual possibility occurs, and because the United States has taken measures to close off investigations, to shroud drone strikes in secrecy, to unfortunately to make sure that media do not know what's happening, the administration is able to say, our strikes are legal. We won't provide any basis for why that's true. We won't let you know what the legal memoranda say. We won't let you know the specifics of what happened in any of these cases. But because there's some theoretical, hypothetical possibility that maybe there could be a legally valid drone strike, we're just going to tell you they're legal. Now go away, stop investigating, and report what I tell you. That's what we've gotten. And that simply is not good enough in a democracy. It's not good enough with a media that should be concerned about human life, and it's not good enough with a society of citizens who should be concerned about human life anywhere, not just in the United States, but human life in Pakistan. And it should also concern us when we know that 176 children, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, have been killed by drone strikes in Pakistan, and as many as 880 civilians. So there are very, very serious legal questions that need to be answered, and I don't think they're going to be answered until people get outraged and demand those answers from authorities.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, though. It's one thing for people to think about people doing that. And it's really important, because here you look at it, and you guys make a point in your study that since Obama came into office, the number of drone strikes and the devastation caused by drones has just increased immensely in 3 years. I mean, it's
five or sixfold, five or six times, exactly.
Yeah. And people keep turning away and turning a blind eye to this. And I was thinking, even these things of, like you were talking about those things that he talked about in terms of a personality strike in a certain sense. If you're going after one person and you think they got this, and while that's bad enough, he also has instituted these things called signature strikes, which to me, just by the very description of them, the character of them, Jesus, that's that. You know, what are we thinking that we could sit and say, okay, this makes sense to me? Tell people what a signature strike is, and what do you think about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. What's most worrisome about the drone practices of the United States are the signature strikes. So let's just go through what the difference is. A personality strike is one where an individual has been identified. The United States military or CIA authorities know who the person is. They have reason to know that the person is involved in al-Qaeda or the Taliban and is plotting an incident imminently, represents a threat, can't be arrested, all of that criteria that would have to be filled, and they decide to target that person. Let's put that to the side. And we should put that to the side because all evidence suggests that that kind of strike, a personality strike, is a small percentage of the strikes that have taken place, particularly in recent years. Where most strikes occur is in what's called the signature strike context. And what does that mean? It means that people who are watching the videos, the images taken by drones, they're watching those images, God knows where, possibly at some CIA location, undisclosed location in the United States, in Nevada, elsewhere. They're watching those images, and they assess from those images, based on the pattern of activity, that the people that they're looking at are combatants, that those people are plotting or engaged imminently in an attack on U.S. Interests, and that they can't be captured. At least that's what they're telling us. And when they establish all that from the video screen, then they fire one Hellfire missile and maybe a second when first responders come to kill those people. That's almost certainly where most of the deaths have occurred. And that is far beyond where a lot of the focus of the media has been in recent months, particularly since the New York Times article that we referred to earlier by Joe Becker and Scott Shane, which talked about Obama's role in making decisions about the first kind of strike, the personality strikes, where the individual who is targeted is known. the focus has been on personality strikes, even though most of the deaths almost certainly have occurred in signature strikes, where someone is looking at a video image and deciding, oh, these people, they're probably up to no good. They're probably doing something that will have lethal consequences for the United States. We don't think we'll arrest them, so we'll kill them. That is a context which, again, I think should raise all sorts of red flags.
Absolutely. And Jim, one last thing, just so people can have this on their minds as they go about their business after hearing this interview, the numbers. What are the numbers involved?
Well, the numbers of people killed?
Yes.
Well, we're looking at, you know, unfortunately, several thousand now in Pakistan. And again, there are others in Yemen, but that wasn't the focus of our report. But the numbers, the best source, which is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, had the numbers through September, through early September, at between 2,562 and 3,325 people, of whom they were able to classify, with all of the ambiguity in the information, between 474 and 881 as civilians and 176 as children. And again, many more of those could be civilians, but there's not enough information to know that. So, you know, significant numbers. If you look at the numbers of people killed, it's on the order of people who were killed in 9/11.
All right, Jim, we're going to have to wrap this up now. But before we go, where can people find the study?
So the site is livingunderdronesalltogether.org. And there they can find the study. There's a video. There's all sorts of resources relevant to this issue. And hopefully, one thing I'll say is this is an issue where, again, to the extent people are involved in outrage, and let people in Congress and the administration and others know, you know, that might start some sort of some process of accountability within the United States.
All right, Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Sure, and thank you very much for that study, too, man. It's really a remarkable piece of work, really important piece of work.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Jim Cavallaro from the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And Jim and the clinic, together with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, are the co-authors of a new report called Living Under Drones. And it's just a compelling, horrifying, and enraging report. So check that one out. And I also want to thank Dr. Alex Rogers, who is the scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out with just a continuation of International War Criminal because it seems just so damn appropriate.
International War Criminal. Information is minimal. And weapons of destruction, they are gasoline to control the earth. So are you sticking around to see what happens? Are you sticking around to see what happens? International War.